The New Testament lesson is found in the Gospel according to Luke chapter 15, verses 1 through 7, found on page 78 if you'd like to follow along. Chapter 15 is probably one of the best known chapters in the Gospel of Luke. It's a trilogy where all three parables speak of the joy of finding what was lost. Listen for the word of God to you. Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. And the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling and saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them." So Jesus told them this parable. When one of you, having 100 sheep and losing one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one that is lost until he finds it. When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders and rejoices. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep that was lost." Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. The word of the Lord. In 33 years of ministry, in 33 years of ministry, I've been asked a lot of questions. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you what they might be. And some of them, I simply did not know the answer. And people would look at me. I said, "I don't." Well, I don't have the mind of God, number one, and I'm not the Son of God. And I refer to that text in Matthew chapter 24, talking about the end of times, and everybody's trying to pick Jesus' brain about when's this going to end, when's it going to end, don't you know? And he says, "Not even the angels in heaven know, I don't know, only God knows." But I could answer this question: where do you get your sermon ideas? How do you do that? Well, if it's Advent, Lent, Holy Week, and Easter, I would always focus on the lectionary text. You know, those cycles A, B, and C that give you an Old Testament reading, a psalm, a gospel lesson, and an epistle, a letter. Because we need to hear those stories over and over again. So I would stick with them. And it's hard preaching during those times because you all know what happened. You know the story. So how do we work with that? Now, I know some pastors that take off a month in the summer, and all they do is take the lectionary that's coming up and plan all their sermons for the entire year. That would drive me crazy. I'm not wired that way. That to me is a punishment. Now, if I was going to say my method, it might be this. I'd say I trust discernment. Attempting to listen to what God would have me share with a congregation and what the preacher Fred Craddock calls overhearing the gospel. I get a lot of my sermons by listening what people are saying around me and then trying to tie a thread in that of some type of awareness, or maybe they're confused about something and all of a sudden I get this idea that might be something to preach about. And then what I used to do when I was starting out in ministry, I'd get an idea at 2 o'clock in the morning, write it down, wake up and write it down, no more. I stopped on that a long time ago because I needed sleep. So what I've done ever since is I put ideas on the back burners of my mind, for lack of a better expression, and there they simmer. And if it's really a good wrestle, 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 an understanding, I hope. But if it's not a good thing, it sort of bubbles away, never be heard or seen again. That's the way it works. Now, I looked at the New Testament lesson for today and realized that about 2 months ago, Pastor Tony alluded to it. And that's enough. I didn't want to do it again because somebody would say, "Well, didn't I just hear that 2 months ago?" For all his sermons, don't you? Yeah, okay. He's not here. Come on. You know. So now, this is how this worked. So I jettisoned that idea. And then Pastor Tony sent Bill Beck and myself an email. saying, could you preach either two Sundays in June or two in July? I couldn't do it in July, but I could do it in June. And then when I was here 2 weeks ago, I was preaching somewhere else last week, I saw that you were doing a summer Sabbath study series, which began last Sunday. And then this question popped in my mind. Before I knew all of that, before I knew any of that, the thing I was focusing on was, why do we go to church? Well, I'll start with my background. Younger brother, 3 years old, younger, Bill, we call him Beat. Parents involved in the First and Central Presbyterian Church, downtown Wilmington, Delaware, Hotel DuPont on one side, Rodney Square, right downtown. For one of us, it was punishment. For the other one, it was something to look forward to, not mentioning any names. And so we would go to get up, go to church, go to Sunday school, then worship. And what got me there were the people. The people that I got to experience as a young kid growing up. There were friends of my father's, my mother's. They'd come over for dinner. We'd go to their house. We'd have desserts together. It was wonderful. And then there were two people in particular that I always tried to seek out. They were employees of the church, Arthur Griffin, a sexton, and Helena Stevenson, sort of the housekeeper type person who would work in the kitchen. They were Afro-Americans. And Arthur stuttered like there was no end to it. He'd always be in a suit, sitting there waiting to see my brother and I and greet us, and eventually it would come out, the greeting would come out. But it was a delightful gentleman. And Helena was the kindest person I've ever met. She was a rather large woman, and she would give us a big hug. Oh, Tommy, it's good to see you. And that continued even after I graduated from seminary, 15 years after that. We were the greatest thing on earth. And then there were the preachers. Some of the best preachers I've ever heard growing up were in that church, without a doubt. And so that influenced me. And then, you know, you got to dangle a carrot sometimes. And we sat back over there in the church, in the back, my mother, you know. And there was a Tom Gary, older gentleman, probably my age now, 70 or something like that. And he would go over to the Hotel DuPont for a brunch. And he'd come to church afterwards. Church started at 11 o'clock, I think. And he would reach in his pocket like this. And my brother and I are sitting behind him, and this hand would come over like this, and one of our hands would go up like this, and he dropped two round butter mints that he got from the Hotel DuPont. Every Sunday, I never told any other kids about that. Where's Mr. Gary? That's where we're sitting. He'd turn around, and we'd, I don't know if we could eat them then or not, but we kept them if nothing else. And then there was the ministers, and there was Bernie Taylor, associate pastor, who was the most Christ-like person I've ever met. And I wanted to go to church just to see what they were going to talk about and how everybody would interact with it. And that was a lot of fun. Then there's some people, the alarm goes off Sunday morning, and what do? You hit the snooze button. Now, I read somewhere you shouldn't hit snooze buttons because it's not good, healthy practice. I can't remember what was behind that. So eventually somebody comes in and says, come on, Sunday's here, you got to get going. But I don't want to go today, I want to sleep in. No, you got to go. And then what? Pastor. Not that that's ever happened. So why do we go to church? If I had to give you an answer, and this could change next Sunday, to worship God and to give thanks to God. If God isn't worthy of our praise, then who is? Worship is an act of love, and we go to church because we love God. Now, our readings this morning speak to the hope and beauty of worshiping God. Psalm 92 is a lectionary text for this morning, fourth Sunday after Pentecost. And in the New Revised Standard Version, down at the notes section, it says, a song for the Sabbath day. So it was sung when the people of Israel worshiped together. And the first four verses name the goodness of the acts of worship. giving thanks to the Lord, singing joyful praises, declaring the steadfast love and faithfulness of God. Those first four verses is the classic example of preaching to the choir. The last verses of that. This is a song of the faithful, no doubt about it. Psalm 92 describes what I would call authentic worship. Worship rooted and grounded in God, blooming and flourishing later on with the love of Jesus Christ. We have Old Testament roots, and here's where they start as far as worship goes. Now, you know styles of worship will vary. And you got to remember that's okay, because if you don't like that style of worship, you don't have to go back, do you? It might grab you and never let you go, or it might be something that, I don't like that. And literally, worship is the people's work. So don't get upset. This appeals to the community and individuals who comprise it. That's how worship works. It's liturgy, literally the people's work. Now, Psalm 92 is a beacon that shows us how inviting the Christian community could look in its worship. Here, centered and focused, is the Lord of the universe. And with him are so many wonderful things: thanksgiving, praise, love, faithfulness, music, joy, stability, growth, productivity, health, and vigor. And guess what? It's all in abundance. It's not stingy. Worship is never stingy. You know, but there are times when we try to sing, I got the joy, 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 joy down in my heart. To each and every one of us, there will be no exceptions. And we come to that gut-wrenching conclusion that there no longer resides in us even a speck of faith the size of a mustard seed. If you are someone you love is teetering on abandoning worship because they have lost all hope, faith, and love in Jesus Christ, then invite them to worship. Now, I'm being kind with that word, invite. Drag them if you have to. And maybe some of you do that already. I don't know. But get them here. And here's why. We do not have to find God. According to Luke's lesson for today, God finds us. Did you ever think that you might be that one sheep for who the 99 are put on hold? Verses 1 to 2 of Luke 15 sets up the entire chapter of those three parables of joy which follow. There's a Near Eastern proverb which puts it in perspective. I saw them eating and I knew who they were. I saw them eating and I knew who they were. And what are the Pharisees and scribes grumbling about? Who Jesus invited to dinner. How absurd. He welcomes the tax collectors and various sinners to dine with him. Table fellowship in that era was more important than we can imagine. If you invited somebody to dinner, regardless of their occupation or what you read about them in the papers, you say, I fully accept you for who you are. If you can't eat with someone, how are you ever going to tell them the good news about Christ? If you can't sit down with somebody that's different than you, how are you going to do that? The answer is you can't. In that parable, each of us should see ourselves among the tax collectors and sinners, welcomed and forgiven in Jesus. I tried to tackle a sheep once in a kilt. Jack, I had a kilt on, and this sheep escaped. And so he said, well, you can tackle that thing. It ran right over. Unfortunately, nobody had their cell phones on, or it had been really out there. It ran me right over. One stupid little sheep. And I understand sheep are stupid. They follow one another, you know, like sheep. You know, we're like sheep. We follow. And how does this one sheep go one way and 99 go the other way? I don't know. And when the guy goes out, the shepherd looked for the one, he puts the 99 in grave danger. He's in the wilderness. He doesn't lock them up in a secure area. They're out where there are predators, all types, thieves, wild animals, dehydration, broken legs, the weather could wipe out half his flock, more than half. And yet he could leave that one sheep out there, take the others to market, and make a profit. And he didn't do it. Let me reframe this parable. On my father's side of the family, I have one first cousin. That's it. On my mother's side, 23 first cousins. 23 of all ages, because my mother is one of 8 siblings. And we would have great family gatherings. And the greatest one was the 4th of July picnic in my Uncle Bob and Aunt Ann's house. They had a farm, really neat farm, on Ramsey Road. And if you kept going straight, you'd go right into the Brandywine Creek. That's where it was. And you might know where Ramsey Road is. Some of you might know where that is. Yep. And that's where the farm is. And I hear the Woodlawn trustees are looking to refurbish the house because it's very unique inside. And we would go there the 4th of July. Father's side of the family would come. Friends would come. We'd have horseshoes because we couldn't throw the horseshoes in because we were too young. Couldn't go that far. We'd have great food because all my aunts had a specialty food. We had great time. And then at night, Grenogue, a DuPont estate sat up on the hill, right less than a half a mile away, and we got to watch the fireworks right in the open. It was glorious. And one of the things that we did as kids, when it started to get dark, and only when it started to get dark, we'd play a game we called Fox and Chickens. You call it hide and seek. It's got all kinds of names. And we would wait till it gets dark because that added some tension to this. And we had to do certain things to make this work. It's a farm, there's a barn, there's a hayloft, there's all kinds of hills and things. So we'd have perimeters around where we could go. And then everybody else, the chickens, would hide. And the fox, all they had to do was tag you and then put you in the chicken pen where you remain forever until he or she ate you. You were toast. And the game would continue until all the chickens were found. Now, as games of this type go, you know what's got to happen. For this game to get off on the right foot, the fox has to count down. We didn't choose 100. It was too complicated for some of my cousins. So we hit 50. Count down to 50, say it loud enough, and then the famous words are, ready or not, here I come. You know what I'm talking about here, folks? Ready or not, here I come. Now say it loud. Say it. Ready? Say it.
Ready or not, here I come.
Okay, because if you didn't hear that, all bets are off. You know? You know? So there is great excitement as the fox in the hunt. Because some cousins aren't as smart as others. They're hiding behind a little bush and they got red on, you know. Ooh, you know, you're back. And I found a great hiding place, great hunts. I climbed up a tree. Nobody's going to look up a tree. Everybody's down on the ground. And I could see the fox, but the fox wasn't looking up. And I'm hanging on this tree. I don't know how high I was up. Maybe about that height. I don't know. And all of a sudden, it starts to get really dark. It's getting dark, and the wind starts to blow a little bit, and the tree starts to move like this. And I'm thinking, you know something? I'd like to be found right about now. Because this tree's moving a little bit, and I don't know if he's got all the chickens yet. And the fact is that there are times when we want to be found. That pen looked mighty inviting. And to be honest, I didn't want to miss all those homemade desserts that my other cousins and family would devour if I didn't get there in time. Being found can be exciting and brings with it a huge sigh of relief. I think everyone has at least a speck of faith, but they might be hiding it for whatever reason. This gives us another reason to come to church, God finds us here. But God can find us anywhere for that matter. But worship is a special time. We love God best when we worship. And if you listen very carefully on any given Sunday, here I come. God finds us always, whether we are ready or not. Amen. Next week,